Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio. Welcome to The Blitz. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, coming to you right here on RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Please check out RenegadeTribune.com and head on over to HeathenHerbs.com as well. Tonight, I have a show for you. Now, it's not a subject that I often speak about, and there are many reasons for that. One of which is I am not really well-versed in economics. I never even took any college classes in economics, though a lot of my friends did. I just was never interested. And also, the reason I don't talk about it so much is that it is our enemy system. I really don't see very much benefit in spending a whole lot of time focusing in on it, other than to just expose how Jewish-controlled it is. I really don't think that the economic system can be fixed without essentially just tearing it all down, tearing it apart. It is unfortunate that you don't really hear so many people even speaking about this all, though. No more end the Fed chants and things like that. That especially came to an end with the end of the Ron Paul era. And with Trump in office, a lot of people just seem to have forgotten about the idea that the Fed is actually not our best friend, not our greatest ally. I used to be a lot more into economic predictions and things like that back when it was 2008, and actually even into 2007, because I was working at Google. I was watching Ron Paul. I was looking into a lot of these alternative websites. You know, I was paying attention to gold and silver and all of that. And I actually was able to basically save a little bit of wealth by buying some gold when I had a little extra money and then selling it a little bit later when it was worth quite a bit more. So I did make some financial investments that paid off a little bit based on the knowledge I had of what was to come. It seemed pretty obvious. The writing was on the wall. And I was speaking about this all when I was working at Google way before anybody else was aware of what was coming. They all thought I was a little bit of a nutter, but then months later, I was asked to give a little presentation at one of our team meetings about how to recruit in an economic downturn, because they were well aware that this is something that I had been looking into for quite some time. And there are definitely ways to recruit people when it seems that there is a little bit of financial instability. You can change tactics just a little bit, especially when you're recruiting for a company like Google, which seems to have quite a bit of stability long term. So we had the 2008 economic crash, which I was talking about, a lot of other people are talking about, and it came to be. I didn't exactly foresee how it would turn out. I actually thought that the consequences would be a little bit more dire, bread lines in the streets and things like that. But things were kind of patched together. There was quite a bit of upheaval, and we know that a lot of wealth was concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. the economic downturn really benefited the top of the top. And the top of the top is primarily made up of Jews, who were the culprits for causing this whole financial meltdown. The people who caused the problem ended up making like bandits afterwards. And they still are running the show on top of everything. And this bubble is not going to be like the 2008 crash, because it's not just going to be housing markets, Fannie and Freddie and all that. This is supposed to be the everything bubble. We're 11 years out, actually more than 11 now, from the 2008 crash, and it seems like we could be due for another economic crash at any point. It could be far worse than 2008. I'm not trying to be some kind of fear-mongering agent here. I'm just trying to tell you as I see it. And it's not something that I really am looking forward to or anything like that, but perhaps there could be things that help get us through this. I am certainly hoping that there are people out there who are taking note and making preparations for what should be done when the Jews crash our economy again. Let's take a look at some of the news that has been coming out recently. Saw this one on Activist Post. It's from this guy, Michael Schneider. I don't trust him one bit. He is a crazy, Christ-insane person. And he has a blog called the Economic Downturn Blog, which seems to indicate that he is... the Economic Collapse Blog. Seems to indicate that he has something of a stake in promoting this idea that the economy is going to collapse. So he's been talking about this for years. And there are valid pieces of data that he can be pointing to. It's just a matter of when, in my opinion. Not if, but rather when the Jews try to crash this economy again. And I will stop at certain places within his article to let you just know where I see some obfuscation or some shilling going on. Here's the article. Brace for impact. The U.S. economy is going down, and it is going down hard. I have so many bad economic numbers to share with you that I don't even know where to start. I had anticipated that the U.S. economic slowdown would accelerate during the fourth quarter of 2019, and that is precisely what has happened. The Federal Reserve is trying to do all that it can to keep us from officially slipping into a recession, and the federal government is literally spending money as if tomorrow will never come. But all of that intervention has not been enough to reverse our economic momentum. So, real quickly, the way he frames things here is that the Federal Reserve is really just desperately trying to save us, trying to keep us from a recession. Is that really what the Federal Reserve is doing? Didn't that Jew, Alan Greenspan, actually admit that the Federal Reserve caused the Great Depression, the economic collapse of 1933 on Wall Street? Didn't he openly admit that? But now I guess the Federal Reserve is a force for good, according to Michael Schneider. And the federal government is spending money so as to try to reverse our economic momentum. A lot of farm subsidies have increased in particular. That's something else to keep an eye on, is the Farmageddon situation. We are really starting to see conditions begin to deteriorate very rapidly now, and 2020 is already shaping up to be the most pivotal year for the U.S. economy since 2008. Let me start my analysis by discussing how U.S. consumers are doing right now. According to CBS News, a major new study that was just released found that 70% of all Americans are struggling financially. I'll believe it. Many Americans remain in precarious financial shape even as the economy continues to grow, with 7 of 10 saying they're struggling with at least one aspect of financial stability, such as paying bills or saving money. The findings come from a survey of more than 5,400 Americans from the Financial Health Network, a nonprofit financial services consultancy. The project, which started a year ago, is aimed at assessing people's financial health by asking about debt, savings, bills, and wages, among other issues. That sure doesn't sound like a booming economy, does it? And even though things are already really tough for millions upon millions of American families, it appears that things are rapidly getting worse. In fact, we just witnessed the largest decline for the Bloomberg Consumer Comfort Index since 2008. Despite stocks soaring to record highs, the Bloomberg Consumer Comfort Index fell last week to 58 from 59.1 a week earlier, and has now plunged 5.4 points in 3 weeks, the biggest such drop since 2008. Yes, the employment situation in this country is still relatively stable for the moment, but the truth is that most of the jobs that have been created in recent years actually pay very little. If you can believe it, 58 million jobs in the United States currently pay less than $793 a week. There are now roughly 105 million production and non-supervisory jobs in the U.S. That's 83% of all private sector jobs. And more than half of them, 58 million, pay less than the average weekly U.S. wage of $793. Many of these jobs don't offer health care or other benefits. These are the best jobs that many Americans can find, and most hours they can get. And I discussed in a previous article, 50% of all U.S. workers currently make less than $33,000 a year. I mean, that's actually pretty accurate, it seems. I mean, people aren't doing that well. And it's really hard to live off of that much money. I mean, and just think, even some new teachers make around that, sometimes even less. And that's really nothing, because when you're taxed to death, you only see a fraction of that. You have to slave away for the state for a significant number of months out of the year. Basically, every year, if you were just to kind of apportion it out in this way, you'd have to start out the year working 3-4 months directly for the federal freaking government, maybe some more for the state, unless you live in Florida like me. And then, finally, you could start earning for yourself. So thanks, Zog, for sucking the very lifeblood out of us, but Michael Snyder doesn't really talk about that aspect of how we're not doing so well. In recent years, many families have increasingly turned to debt in order to maintain their middle-class lifestyles, but now a lot of those debts are starting to go bad. In fact, the New York Fed just announced that serious auto loan delinquencies in the United States have hit a brand new record high. The following comes from Wolf Richter. Serious auto loan delinquencies, auto loans that are 90 days or more past due in the third quarter of 2019, after an amazing trajectory, reached a historic high of $62 billion, according to data from the New York Fed today. Oh yeah, and guys, think about all the student loans. Jeez. For a college education that just taught them how to be great social justice warriors. It taught them how to hate white people, and now they got to pay back all that debt. Do you remember the subprime mortgage meltdown of 2008? Well, a very similar thing is happening right now with auto loans. Meanwhile, the bad economic numbers just keep rolling in. Here are a few new data points that we have gotten since my last article. We just witnessed the worst decline for U.S. industrial production since 2009. The Cass Freight Index has just fallen for the 11th month in a row. Sears has announced that they will be laying off hundreds of workers as they continue to close stores at a very rapid pace. At this point, it is going to be a real challenge to keep U.S. GDP growth above zero for the fourth quarter. If you can believe it, the latest forecast from the Atlanta Fed is projecting a fourth quarter growth rate of just 0.3%. The GDP Now model estimate for real GDP growth, seasonally adjusted annual rate, in the fourth quarter of 2019 is 0.3% on November 15, down from 1.0% on November 8. After this morning's retail trade releases from the U.S. Census Bureau and this morning's industrial production report from the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, the nowcast of fourth quarter real personal consumption expenditures growth and fourth quarter real gross private domestic investment growth, like the hell you know what that means, decreased from 2.1% and negative 2.3% respectively to 1.7% and negative 4.4% respectively. So part of the reason most people, I think, don't pay much attention to the overall economics is they simply don't understand the numbers. You're dealing with these percentages. You're dealing with astronomical figures at certain levels. And it just doesn't really make sense to people, especially when the books are cooked. They're always being cooked, whether it's unemployment numbers or just the health of the economy as measured by the NASDAQ and things like that, or the New York Stock Exchange. It doesn't matter how well certain stocks are doing when the average American is struggling to make it. Oh, but the economy's doing great. This stock index was up so many points. Yay! Well, that doesn't really help out the average American necessarily, does it? Anyway, that is terrible. We aren't talking about 3%. They are projecting growth of 0.3%. And if we slip below zero, we could actually be in the beginning of a recession right now without even realizing it. The Federal Reserve has been attempting to bolster the economy by cutting interest rates and by pumping massive amounts of money into the financial system. They are telling us that this new round of money creation is not QE, which means quantitative easing. You need to know their jargon. But from the beginning, I have been pointing out that it is really more quantitative easing, and many in the financial world are starting to acknowledge this reality. After a month of constant verbal gymnastics and diarrhea from financial pundit sycophants who can't think creatively or originally and merely parrot their echo chambers in hopes of likes, retweets by the Fed that the recent launch of $60 billion in T-bill purchases is anything but QE, whatever you do, don't call it QE4, just call it not QE, please. One bank finally had the guts to say what was so obvious to anyone who isn't challenged by simple logic. The Fed's not QE is really QE. In a note warning that the Fed's latest purchase program, whether one calls it QE or not QE, will have big, potentially catastrophic costs, Bank of America's Ralph Axel writes in the aftermath of the Fed's new program of T-bill purchases to increase the amount of reserves in the banking system. The Fed made an effort to repeatedly inform markets that this is not a new round of quantitative easing, and yet, as the B of A, Bank of America strategist, notes, in important ways it is similar. But as I discussed earlier, all the Fed's efforts are not working. No matter how hard they try, they have not been able to reverse our economic momentum. The system, the whole system, is built this way. It is built to fail. But it's not actually failing the people who run it. It's failing all of us. It is doing exactly as it's intended to do, which is to really take all of the wealth of not only this country, but of the world, and just suck it up into a very few amount of hands and leave us all high and dry. And many people believe that what we have seen so far is just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, trends forecaster Gerald Celente, oh yeah, what a great guy to cite here, is convinced that we are headed for the greatest depression. You think you have a crisis in a country near you now? You haven't seen anything. When the greatest depression hits, people are going to be escaping violence, poverty, corruption. Civil wars are happening in front of everybody's eyes. And you think you've got a homeless problem in a city near you? You haven't seen anything. You're going to see homeless everywhere. This is out of control, and it's only going to get worse as the global economy slows down. Unfortunately, I think he might be right about this. Unless things are drastically changed. And they can be. Do not let anybody convince you that this is all just inevitable. That we have to go down this route. Because the economy just works this way. Nine. There are ways to save our people. It is whether or not we can implement the actions in time. So, and you know what? He's right. What is coming is going to make 2008 look like a Sunday picnic, and our society is completely and utterly unprepared for what is about to happen. But guys, there's enough food. There is enough housing. We have enough food to keep people fed. We have enough houses to keep people sheltered. We have enough energy to keep them warm, or air conditioned, or whatever it might be. So what's the big problem? What is it that we have to deal with? Well, maybe the banks that own a lot of these properties. Maybe the banks that are loaning out at interest and robbing people blind. Maybe the federal government and the Federal Reserve. Maybe if we were just to take all of the money that has been sucked up into this big war machine in particular and start redistributing it, well, we'd be getting in the right direction. Maybe if we were to just, I don't know, take the fortune of people like Jeffrey Epstein, take the fortunes of all the people that are connected to him, and then just distribute them out. Hey, I'm not a communist, but I'll tell you what, redistribution of wealth from these people, I'm all for it. I'm perfectly all for it. Divided equally amongst all the different Americans. Honestly, I don't even care. Throw it to some of the illegals too. That's fine. It's not my money. Throw it to them with the guarantee that or the condition that they have to go back. Here's a couple $1,000 courtesy of Jeffrey Epstein, but you got to go home. There you go. Here's your plane ticket. Hey, win-win for everybody. And you get your cash too. We don't even have to tax people to give them free money. Andrew Yang's talking about all his money bags and everything because of all the joblessness that is going to come about because of the robotics revolution and automation. We don't need to take it from the taxpayer. We'll take it from the filthy rich. How about that? I just recently published this article, or rather republished it, about how $6.4 trillion has been spent on the war on terror. $6.4 trillion. Let me do the math here. $6.4 trillion. We have approximately 330 million people in America. I'm not sure if that's people in America or American citizens. Either way, let's just go with that Masonic number of 330 million. Okay? And that's including little children, babies. This is everybody, men and women. $6.4 trillion divided by 330 million. That's over $19,000 per person. So let's say you've got a household of four people. That's about $80,000 coming in. If we just didn't have the war on terror, if we just nixed all of that, you would have $80,000 right there. That'd be nice. That would certainly help out, right? So let me just read a little bit here about this $6.4 trillion that's been spent on the war on terror since 9/11. The so-called war on terror launched by the U.S. government in the wake of September 11th attacks by Israel has cost us at least 801,000 lives. 801,000. That's a lot. And $6.4 trillion, according to a pair of reports published Wednesday by the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. So, going on here, I just want to point out that 801,000, that seems like a lot, but actually the indirect amount of lives that have been lost, just by starvation and people having to relocate and all this other stuff, it's a lot more. Let me try to find that. Yeah, here we go. As the new Costs of War report and 3.1 million deaths should remind us, part of our responsibility must be to repair some of the immeasurable damage done and to ensure that wars like these never happen again. Okay, so it looks like the total cost in terms of lives is around 3.1 million deaths. And that is a lot. So those people would all still be alive if Jews didn't launch the war on terror after attacking the Twin Towers. And, we'd be much better off. We'd have our wealth. We'd have less veterans hooked on heroin. We'd have less suicides of our young people. We'd have more jobs here at home. Everybody'd be much better off. I don't care. Oh, but Boeing gets to employ this person. Oh, Lockheed Martin gets to employ that person. Oh, yeah, great. Hey, a $2.1 million bomb was dropped on Syria. Yes! I'm glad we got to pay for that. Freedom. Don't you just love our freedom to be enslaved to Jewish supremacists? I just love it. So, don't you all remember that famous little September 10th, 2001 press conference with Donald Rumsfeld, where he talked about how the rabbi, well, he didn't mention actually that it was Rabbi Dov Zakheim, the comptroller, who was responsible for the, $2.3 trillion? Yeah, that was missing in the Pentagon. They announced $2.3 trillion, but I'm pretty sure it came out that it was actually like $3.2 trillion that was missing, that Rabbi Dov Zakheim just couldn't seem to account for. And then, what a quinky-dink, the next day, a plane, actually it was a missile, went right into the accounting office, the place that was responsible for doing an investigation as to where that missing $2.3 trillion went. So even if we were just to have $2.3 trillion that Rabbi Dov Zakheim just couldn't seem to find, that would certainly help us out a lot too. We'd have the $2.3 trillion and then the $6.4 trillion that we've spent, that the U.S. government has spent in the wake of September 11th. We're really getting somewhere. We'd really be pretty wealthy if we didn't have Jews running our whole freaking system, our banking system, our media system, our foreign policy. Wow, they're really just robbing us blind. And you know what? That $6.4 trillion, that $2.3 trillion, that's kind of chump change when you consider the $21 trillion that the Pentagon has actually lost. Oh, yeah. And they couldn't find it in their little audit, too. So, before we talk a little bit more about this, let's just try to understand $21 trillion. That's a lot of money. Okay? So, we talked about just dividing $6.4 trillion between the 330 million Americans, and you get over $19,000. Well, if you take the $21 trillion that's missing, divide that by 330 million Americans, that's $64,000 per person. So you add that to the $19,000, well, you're really getting somewhere. You're getting about $83,000 per person. And then you add in the $2.3 trillion divided. Yeah, you're looking at what? $85,000 or so per person. So if you've got a household, just you and your loved one, you're going to start a new family. Well, guess what? You would have $170,000 more if we were just to take all of that missing money and money that's been spent on the war on terror and give it back to the people. Yep, $170,000. You could buy a nice new home. You'd be a lot better off, wouldn't you? But no, the Jewish supremacists who are waging war for greater Israel, they need it. The needy Jewish supremacists, I mean, really, they're our greatest ally. We just got to fork over all of our money and then wonder why we're in a great damn depression. Yep. And actually, you know what? Since this war on terror has affected all of Terra, the world, well, what if we were just to divide that $21 trillion that's missing and just give it to everybody in the world, every single person who exists in the world? Do you know what would happen? $21 trillion divided by 7.5 billion, you know, for the amount of people in this world, an estimate, that's $2,800 per person. So just the money that the Pentagon can't account for, if we were to redistribute it all commie-like, the commies actually don't do this kind of stuff, but if we were to do that whole redistribution of wealth equally across all the people in the world, $2,800 per person. Wow. Think about how much that'd be worth for all the poor people in the world who barely make a few dollars a day. That is some serious wealth that has been sucked right up like cocaine up a Hollywood Jew's nose. Sucked right up the big schnoz. So sickening, so infuriating. I wonder why we're in this Great Depression when the Fed's doing this and that. The Fed's doing everything they can to help us. No. This is all engineered. They want us poor. They want us hungry. They want us easily controlled. Think of how many times throughout history they have done this to people. Look at what they did to the Weimar Republic. Look at what they did to Ukraine, starving them out. These people have a history of impoverishment, starving, genocide, torture. Oh, and rape too. Because when people are really poor, they get really desperate. And that's why you had children being sold to Jewish supremacists on the streets of Berlin, back before the National Socialists took over. Anyway, real briefly about the missing $21 trillion. This was from almost a year ago. Search for missing $21 trillion comes up empty as Pentagon fails first audit in 71-year history. Despite being legally required to conduct audits since the early 1990s and holding a staggering $2.2 trillion in assets, the Pentagon held its first ever audit this week, which it unsurprisingly, spectacularly failed. According to a senior official, the results were so bad that the discrepancies could take years to resolve. The Department of Defense is handed hundreds of billions of dollars annually, most of which comes from taxpayers. Hey guys, what if you just had, I don't know, like you couldn't account for, I don't know, like $100,000, $200,000? Do you think, you know, the IRS auditing you would just kind of let this slide? But the Pentagon, they can be missing $21 trillion. No big deal. No biggie. In a press conference akin to a sketch from a comedy show, Deputy Secretary of Defense Patrick Shanahan asked, "So you guys know why I came down here today?" To which a reporter replied, "To see if we ate donuts." Shanahan then casually informed reporters that the notoriously bloated and unchecked Department of Defense had failed its first audit in the department's increasingly expansive 71-year history. "We failed the audit, but we never expected to pass it." At the launch of the audit, which began last week, Pentagon spokesperson Dana H. White proclaimed that it demonstrates our commitment to fiscal responsibility and maximizing the value of every taxpayer dollar that is entrusted to us. Oh, sure, I believe that. According to a statement from the Pentagon, the goal of the audit was to reinforce taxpayer confidence that their money is spent responsibly. According to figures from the Pew Research Center, only 18% of Americans trust that Washington does what is right all of the time. Really, 18% of Americans are that retarded? I mean, I could kind of believe that, but geez, it should be a lot less than that. 1,200 auditors sifted through financial records spanning the DoD's massive omnipresence. To put it into perspective, the audit looked at spending on weapon systems, military personnel, and general property, each of which is a broad category for vast amounts of annual spending. The Pentagon certainly has some explaining to do. A trillion here, a trillion there. Before you know it, you're taking real money. You're talking real money. Earlier this year, the Pentagon announced that $21 trillion of taxpayer money had simply disappeared. The announcement attributed the missing funds to the DoD's failure to conduct audit trails in sufficient detail. Throughout its long unaudited history, the DoD has a notorious record of irresponsible and downright wasteful spending. Over the past few months, it's come to light that the DoD has flushed $14,000 each, on 3D-printed Pentagon-shaped toilet seats and guzzled cups for $1,280 apiece. In the past, the DoD has also thrown $436 away on hammers, $117 on soap dish covers, and $999 on pliers. This is a mafia racket, guys. A protection racket. Oh, we're going to protect you and keep you safe as we do everything that the Jewish supremacists in Israel want us to do with your young sons and daughters and all your hard-earned wealth. Although wasteful, these are some of the Pentagon's more innocent purchases. The others, however, come at the cost of human lives. As a multi-trillion dollar organization, the United States Department of Defense, do they really defend us? Is currently waging war in 8 countries, including Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, Libya, and until troops withdraw and airstrikes stop, Syria. That hasn't stopped any. It's difficult to tally the cost of in civilian lives and mass destruction of an annual budget rapidly approaching the trillion-dollar mark, and that's something that likely won't be analyzed in any audit the Pentagon conducts on itself. So guys, let's talk briefly here about how Germany was able to tackle these similar issues that they dealt with in the 20s and into the 30s. Hitler, the unemployed, and the autarky. Some observations after 50 years. This was written by Rudolph Jordan in 1984. In Germany and throughout the democratic world, the problem that disturbingly dominates politics today is rising unemployment and its simple cause, lack of jobs for the workforce available. The worker has a right to employment. In place of the long post-war period of economic growth in Germany, known as the Wirtschaftswunder, which saw some 4.8 million foreign workers attracted to the country, the situation now is that nearly 2 million German workers seek employment and cannot find it. Their desperation today echoes events that profoundly impressed Germany and Europe, indeed the world, half a century ago. When the words Hitler ante portas resounded at a time when Germany was on the edge of final collapse. What was the situation at that time? The president of the Reich, Hindenburg, appointed Adolf Hitler as chancellor on 30 January 1933. In his subsequent address to the German nation, Hitler stressed that Hitler stressed that two problems were the most serious of all those burdening German society. Their solution demanded the nation's complete attention and energy. In the clearest possible terms, Hitler stated these two problems, unemployment and the plight of the peasant. Both rose like specters out of the ruins of the Weimar Republic. Both called nationalists and socialists alike to action. Just how serious were the circumstances in Germany? Between 1929 and 1932, the yearly average of the officially recognized unemployment rose from 1.8 million to the startling figure of 6.1 million. Out of a workforce of 18 million, an unemployment rate of 34%. The figure of 6 million was reached as early as February 1932, which saw the workless standing in long lines outside of government employment offices. Berlin, capital of the Reich, had a population of 4.2 million, of whom 650,000 were out of work, almost 11% of total German unemployment, although Berlin held less than 7% of the German population. These piteous numbers actually understate the misery, because farm laborers and domestic help were not included in unemployment statistics. To these figures must be added the 3 million of those working in December 1932 who were only working short hours. About one-third of the German workforce in 1932 had no active role in the nation's economy. The income of the employed fell from $5.7 billion in 1929 to $2.6 billion in 1932. Income tax statistics tell us that of about 31 million Germans drawing an income, 69.2% receive less than $286 yearly. 22.7% received between $286 and $714 yearly. Only 8.1% received more than that. Of a workforce of 18 million, about 12 million had jobs. Of the 6 million workless, more than one-third were excluded from unemployment insurance and emergency employment relief. As welfare recipients, they were given an average of $13.09 monthly. The consequence was that the state in 1932 doled out about 16% of all salaries and wages, or 9% of the total income of the German people. In early 1938, before the union with Austria, the statistically unemployed in Germany numbered only 507,000, or 2.8%, a figure that Roosevelt's New Deal did not equal until February 1943, a good 14 months after the United States had formally entered the war. After World War II, Germany's extraordinary socialist achievement was belittled by the use of fantastic lies. People were told that the 1930s success owed solely to the rearmament that supposedly began immediately after Hitler had assumed office. But when we realize, when in fact real rearmament and remilitarization began, we can see that the foregoing table tells us a very different story. When universal conscription was introduced at the end of 1935, more than 4 million of the previously unemployed were already earning a living again. At the end of 1938, the Minister of Labor reported that over 1 million jobs were going begging. There were no longer was any unemployment. The problem from then on was a shortage of workers. The unique success of the German attack on unemployment did not owe to some solitary decision made in the highest circles of government, but instead to an ideal partnership of team spirit, which included the state, industry, the party, and the workers themselves. Political leaders sat down with the relevant economic specialists to realize in practice what specialists had recommended in the light of their experience. To master the crisis and to create jobs, the state spent an additional $1.33 billion during this period, that is, up to 1935. The creation of jobs turned on this settled rule of action. First, to each a job, and thereafter, to each his job. How, in contrast, this attitude is in today's welfare ethic. The full significance of the feat accomplished from 1933 to 1935 can be truly understood only when considered in light of the political situation abroad. Marked as it was by the first declaration of war against Germany, which the London Daily Express of 24 March 1933 announced on page 1 with the headline, "Judea declares war on Germany." What this actually meant for Germany's new beginning is found in the text of the article. Entire Israel, the world over, closes ranks to declare economic and financial war on Germany. 14 million Jews in every corner of the world have united as one to declare war on the German persecutors of their co-religionists. Germany will have a high price to pay. The Reich is faced with a complete boycott in commerce, finance, and industry. And it did nothing to stop them. The power of the German people overpowered those 14 million Jews and all of their economic resources and all of their control over Western governments. Germany still powered on and eliminated 6 million from the unemployment line, that is. What Germany in fact achieved, this declaration of war notwithstanding, was admiringly acknowledged abroad. Churchill, for one, in England, and at home by one of the leading German economic theorists whose membership in the present, until late 1982, ruling party, the Social Democrats in West Germany, adds a democratic legitimacy, should that be required, to his views. In 1935, while a student in the University of Heidelberg, he wrote his doctoral thesis, honored with the summa cum laude, entitled Work Creation and Financial Order, to quote from it, "The German organized attack on unemployment has raised and expanded the concept of jobs creation from its literal meaning of relief work to something beyond mere stimulation of the economy until there is an overlapping contribution from all the forces of economic life. After the statutory beginnings in June 1931 and July 1932, and after the National Socialist Revolution, the effort developed into a comprehensive service and educational undertaking of the whole nation. The crowning achievement of this undertaking was that it dutifully drew the workers into it." Who will want to contradict the former Federal Minister for Economic Affairs under Helmut Schmidt, namely Professor Karl Schiller, member of the Social Democratic Party? Yes, he was the author of the expert evaluation above. Those of us who went about our work in those days, fully conscious of carrying out a nationalist and socialist revolution, see in this Social Democrats' 1935 words a ringing confirmation of this part of our intention. And here's some commentary from Ronald Klett. And this will close us out here for the evening, though there is some more I could read about this subject. I also recommend that you check out Richard Tedor's Hitler's Revolution, which has a lot of good work about all of the economic stimulus and just how great it was for workers. The KDF program, Strength Through Joy, and what was done to really bring Germany to such high heights when the rest of the world was wallowing in depression, especially the United States, with FDR's New Deal supposedly doing wonders for people while actually just confiscating gold, destroying food crops, and all sorts of great things like the Dust Bowl and whatnot. Why was National Socialist Germany... This is by Ronald Klett, okay? This is just some commentary. Why was National Socialist Germany so spectacularly successful in restoring full employment, whereas the major democracies, the United States, Great Britain, and France, had to employ a world war to end their economic miseries? Strangely, or perhaps not so strangely, this question is rarely asked. Rudolf Jordan has just provided part of the answer, as also Professor Dr. Schiller. Hitler himself answered the question. Chatting with his circle of guests on the evening of 12 November 1941, he said, "This is the secret of my four-year plan. I have woven the people into an autarchical economy. I did not solve the problem of unemployment through war industry. The fashionable view in America as in Germany is that the National Socialists achieved full employment by converting Germany into a fortress." The English historian A.J. P. Taylor spoke just this typical view. The full employment which Nazi Germany was the first European country to possess depended in large part on the production of armaments. But his next clause modifies this claim. But it could have been provided equally well, and was to some extent, by other forms of public works from roads to great buildings. His following sentence further dilutes the claim. The Nazi secret was not armament production, it was freedom from the orthodox principles of economics. Taylor belabors the point quite needlessly because 29 pages earlier he had obligingly, although perhaps unwittingly, strangled fashion in the womb. Even in 1939, the German army was not equipped for a prolonged war, and in 1940, the German land forces were inferior to the French in everything except leadership. If German full employment depended in large part on the production of armaments, should not Germany in 1939 have been equipped for a prolonged war? Should its land forces in 1940 have been inferior to the French in everything except leadership? The actual statistics cited by economic historian John Kenneth Galbraith answer these two questions. Even in May 1940, the German arms industry accounted for less than 15% of total industrial production. This 8 months after the war's beginning. By 1941, the figure was 19%. By 1942, 26%. By 1943, 38%. And finally, in 1944, it reached 50%. They did not want to focus all of their folkish energy on producing armaments. That is not what the National Socialists ever wanted. They were very upset that they had to spend so much damn time fighting this war. What they wanted to do was rebuild Germany. They wanted to have great high culture. They wanted to raise their people up to levels they have never seen before. Yet they were being dragged down, dragged into this war by an international clique. The answer to this basic question raised in the first sentence of this commentary has three basic parts. One, Keynesian deficit spending, Jordan's view and Galbraith's. Two, the workers drawn into the economy to become an enthusiastic part thereof, Professor Dr. Schiller. Three, autarky, insofar as possible, Hitler. AJP Taylor notwithstanding, the armaments industry was an inconsequential factor in German full employment, but Taylor could have pointedly aimed his claim at the democracies both during and after World War II. In the closing chapter of the second volume of The Decline of the West, Oswald Spengler, in his inimitably fascinating and perspicacious ways, weighs the frenzied private commercial activity required to float the modern economy. And so we quote from him here. The ancient wrestle between the productive and the acquisitive economies intensifies now into a silent gigantomachy of intellects, fought out in the lists of the world cities. This battle is the despairing struggle of technical thought to maintain its liberty against money thought. The dictatorship of money marches on, tending to its material peak in the Faustian civilization as in every other. And now something happens that is intelligible only to one who has penetrated to the essence of money. If it were anything tangible, then its existence would be forever. But, as it is a form of thought, it fades out as soon as it has thought its economic world to finality, and has no more material upon which to feed. It thrust into the life of the yeoman's countryside and set the earth a-moving. Its thought transformed every sort of handicraft. Today it presses victoriously upon industry to make the productive work of entrepreneur and engineer and laborer alike its spoil. The machine with its human retinue, the real queen of this century, is in danger of succumbing to a stronger power. But with this, money too is at the end of its success, and the last conflict is at hand, in which the civilization receives its conclusive form, the conflict between money and blood. He was writing immediately after World War I, 65 years ago, when economic activity was far less the fever it is today. The implication of his words reminds us that every fever has its end. There is a hidden juncture at which the fresh increments of human energy, resourcefulness, vision, inventiveness, courage, resolution, farsightedness, toil, optimism, and speculation, ingredients essential to a sustaining commerce at the desired level or to screw it up to an even higher pitch, mysteriously lack their customary potency, or even fail utterly to be present. At this juncture, the terrifying descent begins, an adventure the beginnings of which cannot be many years in the future. As part of the next great historical movement in the world, not Germany alone, will return in its respective parts, be these nations or groups of nations, to autarky, as Hitler sensibly desired for the German people. Sometime in the future, our interdependent national economies, at present susceptible to paroxysms of shivering from every major storm abroad, will be looked upon as the superstition they always were, the 20th century myth of the Fountain of Youth. By the early 1930s, this fountain had run dry for Germany. Now it runs dry for the world. The German example in coping with and superseding this problem will not be forgotten. And yes, everyone, we must not forget that there are solutions to these problems. And I hope everyone listening out there realizes what will be in store for themselves and their families, even if they think they've got a nice little cushy job now, maybe even a government job, if these Jews get their way. So everything that we hold dear is being threatened by this economic system. So we must do everything in our power to get out from under this economic system and to create a new one that is based on proper fundamentals, which were shown to us as a great example in the 1930s. Success from getting out from under the Jewish system has been shown before, but it was limited. It was only in Germany. And some other places were catching on. But we need the whole world to catch on this time. And we must not allow our good Goyim brethren to take down and take out those who end up breaking free. We all must break free from this system together. So thanks so much for listening here tonight. Thank you for supporting this network with your Zogbucks, if you can. And please, do check out heathenherbs.com. We'll be back with you all again soon.